Welcome to The Art of Advisory. My name is Hector Garcia, and I'm with my co-host, Kirk Bowman. Hey, Kirk, how are you? How you been lately?
I'm doing good, Hector. What's going on in your world?
Well, just extremely, I don't want to say the word busy because we kind of knocked down the concept of the word busy last time we had a conversation, but I've been working a lot, let's call it that.
So why are you working so much, man? What's going on?
Well, it's tax season.
Tax season? What the heck is that?
Oh man, that's a deep question. So tax season is this man-made construct that that government and the accounting profession kind of got together and said, between January 15th and April 15th, we're going to be insanely, insanely busy doing tax returns for a whole bunch of people. But it's not just tax returns. It's the work in preparation of tax returns because, unfortunately, a lot of folks show up in February or March and say, do my taxes. And in some cases, we have to retroactively go back and enter 12 months worth of transactions, construct financial statements, and do what we call post-mortem tax planning, you know, try to mitigate all the mistakes the client made along the way. And this multiplies times 250 clients, 300 clients. So it's a big concentration of work in a short amount of period, in a short amount of time. And it's just very stressful. It's just a lot of work. For some practice, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I don't know if there's any other industries that are working this way, but there are some practices that actually make more in those 3 months that they do in the rest of the year, all the other 9 months combined. So it's kind of an interesting concept. So for a lot of practitioners, this is kind of like, you know how we make our money. And during the rest of the year, we kind of just prepare for tax season. I'd probably say that's probably the best way I can explain it. I mean, there's possibly more detailed explanation I can go into, but I would say that's kind of what tax season is all about.
So I've heard this phrase tax season quite a bit from my friends in the accounting and bookkeeping world. And one concept that I challenged you on, it's been several weeks, is just this idea that why do you have to have a tax season? Why can't you plan around it and restructure your business in a way so that you don't have this insanely crazy season, you know, 3 months out of the year? In fact, as you were describing it, the first thing that occurred to me was a retailer during Christmas season. I mean, literally, you know, you talked about, you know, making 75% of your revenue in those 3 months. Well, that's kind of what retailers do, right? During November and December, they either make or break their entire year in those 2 months. And sounds like at least for some accountants or bookkeepers, the same thing's happening. I interviewed a gentleman on my show, and the title of the episode was The Accountant Who Doesn't Do Taxes. Now, he kind of took the extreme approach. He just said, you know what, I'm not doing any tax work. I'm going to partner with somebody else. And he actually has another CPA who he refers all the tax work to, and that CPA in turn refers consulting and advisory work to him. But number one, it takes a while to get there if you're going to get there. Number two, that's a pretty big business model change, and you really have to be confident and committed to the change and plan for it. But along the same lines, I have worked with one or two accountants who had managed this better, who had done it in a way that when, quote, tax season came around, either the return was already done, all the prep work was done. Basically, they had kind of said, okay, we're going to help our clients change from kind of this, you know, this reactionary type of posture to tax season to responsive. And actually, you know, you talked about, you know, post-mortem tax planning. Well, actually planning in advance, right? And so literally, the accountant I'm thinking about, you know, he would sit down with me, you know, 12 months in advance and go, okay, not only what happened last year and how what do we need to implement, you know, moving forward, but also, okay, what does the next year look like? What are you anticipating if revenue stayed the same, if revenue went up, if revenue went down? And so that's really where I'm coming from with this idea of, should you have a tax season? Can you plan a practice in a way, run a practice in a way that avoids this nightmare season the first quarter of the year?
There is some truth to that, and there's some things that may be a little bit challenging. So you use the example of retail, and I'm an ex-retail employee. I used to work for Best Buy in Circuit City for about 6 years combined. And you know, Black Friday, Christmas, TVs for Super Bowl. I mean, anytime between November and February, for the most part, it's just very, very busy. I mean, there's gift card redemptions. There's seasonality, and there are aspects of seasonality that you can't really do much for. Now, when I used to work in Best Buy, you know, we were not frantically ordering new product as we were running out during November and December. We had enough stock, so there was an essence of planning throughout the year in order to fulfill the needs of our demand during that time. But there was still an increase in staff. There was an increase in holiday hours, an increase in capacity overall. So there are aspects of seasonality that we just can't escape. So, but to your point, you're building a process in place in which you tell your client, I will not accept, you know, 12 months worth of work when you show up in my desk in January. If we're not prepared by December, we will simply not take you. That is possible. I mean, that I would venture to say that would be a really bold business move for any accountant that still wants to do tax, but doesn't want to be incredibly stressed out during tax season. I personally, I'm a tax accountant, so I do some tax work, and I've done that over the years. I have transformed some of my clients' behaviors over the years, but I will confess that I haven't fully implemented. So I am still, you know, pretty much very hectic and busy during quote unquote tax season. But I am doing this podcast in the middle of tax season. I'm still producing YouTube videos. I'm still involved in the Facebook community, chatting with colleagues and small business owners. I'm still, you know, going out there and teaching QuickBooks. So I'm still doing things that are not traditional tax work during tax season, because I have created some of those behaviors with some of my clients and some of my team members, but I haven't fully done it. And I will tell you why, Kirk, and I would have to confess. It is laziness from including myself. It is laziness because it is too easy to get new clients during tax season. It is too easy because, you know, this is a government made urgency, right? Almost no one shows up on your desk really desperate to know their profitability for last year, 3 months, you know, 3 months later, unless they have to report it to someone. So that's a really kind of an interesting concept, because if you're in the business of doing something that the client is forced to do, it's hard to see yourself as a person that actually adds value. You feel that you're more of a compliance person, or you're a person that's just trying to, you know, get the client over this, you know, government mandate, right? So it is something to think deeply about. And now that we're discussing it, you know, I don't want to give up doing tax returns. I actually have a master's in taxation. So I want to exercise what I studied. And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy doing tax planning, but I still take clients during tax season. I mean, this year, I think I've taken the most amount of new clients I have ever taken. And it is my fault. It is because I accept them. And that's laziness, right? Because it's too easy, Kirk. It is, they come in, they're desperate. You know, the last accountant got lost or died or retired or whatever. And they're like, I need a new accountant. You were recommended. I saw your video on YouTube. I saw an article. You know, I searched you in Google. I saw you in the Yellow Pages, whatever. And then we, you know, we take that opportunity as, hey, it's a new client. We should not you know, even think about not taking them. It's a new client. We always take new clients. And it's part of this culture that our industry has, that it's all about growing the number of clients. And I'm a culprit of it. That's how I've been growing my practice in the past 10 years. And I'm evolving, but I'm admitting to you that we've been in this trap that is all about volume, all about volume. And because all this volume comes in during tax season, new volume, it's, you know, there's two sides of the story. There's our current clients in which we otherwise could have had the opportunity to train and walk them through the process through the year to be prepared for tax season. That's one group of clients. And then you have the whole other group that you probably never talk to, you never reach out to. They know you, maybe you do this every single year. It's kind of like a ritual. And they just show up with all this work and all at the same time. And because, you know, we can make the capacity for it, because we can overwork our employees, because we can work a little overtime, we decide to just take it. And, you know, it's laziness and greed, I guess. but that is our reality, Kirk. And just trying to be as upfront with you as possible as a person that's in the middle of this whole thing and has been for a decade.
So several key elements that you pointed out that I want to get to kind of one by one. First, I just appreciate your honesty, right? You kind of said, well, yeah, we could plan for it, but then we get lazy. And so let's approach it from the standpoint of, okay, what are the elements that would be necessary in order to change the business to one that does not have a tax season, to one that just does not become insanely busy? The first term that you mentioned that I think probably is the most important is resource planning. You would have to get in a position where, number one, your resources are not as heavily demanded during this 3-month period. Well, what does that involve? Well, it means probably several things. Number one, for existing clients, you would have to actually do tax planning, right? Sit down with them a year in advance, have them on some type of structure where you're not waiting till January to say, okay, do you have your shoebox of receipts? You know, have you kept QuickBooks up to date? All that kind of thing. That part of the service you're providing is you are monitoring that to make sure it's being taken care of on a regular basis, providing training, possibly maybe even doing the data entry for them if that is the scope of the engagement with them, but that becomes ongoing. When you talk about resource planning, primarily I would think it's a human capital type of planning that you're needing to do, right? You need to make sure that you have the team members available to do the monitoring, to do the training, to do the planning, etc. It's really, you know, is our team in a position to serve the commitments that we have made during this time period? Is there something else with resource planning that you would take into account other than just personnel?
A lot of it is discipline. Okay. It's the ability to say no, or the ability to say this condition needs to happen in order for us to move forward. What you're saying, assumes that the customers are going to say yes. And what are they going to say yes to? Well, they're going to say yes to paying us a monthly fee for a service. They're going to say yes to responding to, hey, who you wrote this check to, that sort of thing. They're going to say yes to reviewing the numbers in a monthly or quarterly basis so they can take action. They have to say yes to making an estimated tax payment quarterly during the year. So, It's easy for me to sit here and pass blame to my customers, because this is what all of us do, by the way. You know, I go to a lot of accounting conferences, and you know, we have this thing, you know, where we have certain things that we say, and we just understand each other because we just assume that customers are the problem, and we are the ones that just have to deal with it, and that's, you know, that's what it is. But it's not. It's the discipline comes from our practice. If we are the ones taking in the clients under those circumstances, if we're the ones, let's call it condoning the behavior, if we're the ones not standing our ground saying this is how we function, then we're going to be on this rut forever. We're going to be dealing with this, and we can complain about, you know, we complain about our clients doing this or not doing this all day long, but we're the ones that are allowing it. I mean, look, Kirk, you don't have a tax season because you're not an accountant, because you don't take accounting clients. So that tells you right there that it's a personal choice. It is absolutely a personal choice. I make the personal choice to take new clients during tax season and get super stressed out, get everybody in my firm stressed out. And that is something that I absolutely must change. But I believe it's gathering strength around building a discipline around what you will allow and will not allow your clients to do. And when we say not allow your clients to do, that's code for being okay with not taking them. I don't preach what I say, because at this point I have taken I take most new clients. There's some that do cross the line on ethics and what I stand for and how they do things and how aggressive they are. And there are some that I just don't take or they're just not the right fit. But for the most part, if they do something legal and they breathe and they can pay the bill, we probably take them. And I think that may be the primary issue, is that we kind of get accustomed that every year we're going to have this influx of new clients. We're going to have an increase of revenues at 15, 20%, whatever. And we know that we're going to make some extra money during the tax season, so we just work hard at it. And we don't make a change. I don't make a change. I haven't made the change. And a lot of my colleagues just don't make the change. And they're okay with it. And you know what? We can vilify tax season all day long, but it is something that we've grown accustomed to, and we just do it. But I actually agree with you. I think the quality of the work would get better if we're not stressed. I think the quality of your employees will certainly increase significantly if they're not stressed, right? Because there's a lot of big firms that make their employees work until 10, 11 o'clock at night during tax season. I don't do that. I mean, I work myself until 11 o'clock at night, but I don't make my employees do so. So there's something to what you're saying, and I don't think it's just something that you're just saying and suggesting. I think that there's something deep there, and I think the solution is not that difficult. It is just helping the accounting firm, the accounting managers, just kind of make that switch and say, no, tax season doesn't control you. You control your world. You control your practice. You just have to make significant changes, have high levels of discipline around saying no and not taking that new business or being okay with losing it. I think that's where the answer is somewhere. I don't know what the magic answer is, but I think it's somewhere around there. And then being okay with doing that transition, going through whatever the financial repercussions are of making a business model shift. Because I think that maybe that's the issue, Kirk. I think making the business model shift and the strains and stress and worry about change and the short-term financial repercussions of making that shift is what we're most afraid of. I don't know if you've had experience with dealing with clients having to make that, business model shift and those short-term anxieties.
Well, you nailed it. It is certainly a choice that you make. It's never going to happen accidentally. It requires discipline. And the choice that you're making is the choice of your business model. I referred to the accountant who doesn't do tax returns earlier. He made a bold, some might say, risky choice not to do tax returns. But he figured out how was that business model going to work. Well, part of it was he knew it wouldn't work if he didn't provide a way for his customers who had tax returns as part of what they needed. If he wasn't going to provide how those returns were going to be completed, then they were likely going to go somewhere else entirely. So he set up a relationship with somebody who was willing to take on. And so that was actually part of his resource planning. His resource planning in that instance was, I'm not going to provide the resource, not on my payroll, but I am going to have someone who is willing to do that. And so that was part of his business model, and it was part of the discipline. Now, I think the discipline that we have to start with, well, the first discipline is the decision of the business model. You have to make a commitment, a choice. A lot of us will make New Year's resolutions, and if you go to the gym to work out, I hate going to the gym in January. Not because I don't like working out, but because all of a sudden the gym's twice as crowded and I have to go a little bit earlier, you know, or a little bit later to get a machine because everybody made their resolution, you know, to lose their 10, 15 pounds from the holidays or whatever. Well, fortunately, by Valentine's Day, the gym's cleared out because now people are worried about, you know, making sure their sweetheart knows that I love you. But it's not that kind of commitment we're talking about. We're talking about one where you decide you're going to do it and then you remain focused on that outcome for 12 to 18 months until it becomes a reality. This is the same type of commitment that's required to convert a practice from hourly billing to value pricing. It's the same type of change. In fact, sometimes when a practice makes the move to value pricing, they will also include this type of change as part of the commitment. So resource planning capacity is part of it. But the other part of the discipline, once you've made the business model choice, is client selection. And in my opinion, that really is the most important aspect. Because if your client selection plan is to take any and all comers when and if they come, you can't do it. You have to decide what type of customer you want. Now, there are different degrees of client selection, but one type of client selection that you alluded to is, okay, if you don't have your stuff together by and pick a date, December 1, January 1, earlier, whatever. If a new customer comes to us past that date and they're not already organized, we're simply going to say, all right, appreciate you coming to us. We would love to help you. Unfortunately, you have come to us too late in the year for us to meet the April 15th deadline. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to commit to two things. Number one, we're automatically going to file an extension now because we're not going to be able to help you get this done by, you know, April 15th. You need to file an extension, and we have a plan and a process in place to help new customers who come to us late to help them file by the extension. But also as part of that process, we're going to help you get out of this reactionary posture that you have been in. In fact, coming to us this late, we consider it to be reactionary. We're going to help you become somebody who anticipates this in advance. We also have a process of that. And so you literally sell them a product, if you will, the product being you're no longer going to be somebody who is, oh, shoot, it's April 1st, I got to do my taxes, to somebody who goes, oh, yeah, I'm going to have to pay those taxes next year. Let's make sure we set up a bank account and let's make sure that we transfer an amount over on a monthly basis to cover, you know, the self-employment taxes or payroll taxes or whatever it is. Let's make sure that we look ahead and go, wow, okay, summer's your busy season and we know this year you're going to need to buy another vehicle. How's that going to impact your tax year? When's the best time to buy it? Do we need to buy it earlier because, you know, the 179 depreciation laws are changing or anticipating they might change? Those kind of things. It's that type of approach with your customers. And if there was one thing I would advocate for accountants and bookkeepers is create a productized service around this idea of, hey, you come to us past our internal deadline for meeting April 15th, but here's how we'll help you file it with an extension. But as part of that, we're going to require you to do the things necessary to not need an extension next year. Response to that?
Yeah, that was a lot to unpack there. So I'm gonna respond in two parts. I'm gonna talk about the seasonality concept outside of the accounting world, and then I'll talk about extensions too, because that's another important tool that we have that we could leverage so we don't have this crazy tax season. But I want to talk about seasonality. You talked about going to the gym in January because, you know, the masses go this way, or, you know, going to have dinner in a romantic restaurant in Valentine's Day, right? Or going to, I don't know, a sports bar during Super Bowl. Like all these things that happen during seasonal times, I think most of us don't want that. Like, you know, we don't want to go to Disney World in Christmas because it's absolutely insane, right? We don't want to go to Times Square. Well, some people do in New Year's because it's absolutely insane, right? We don't want to go to the gym in January because it's absolutely insane. So what happens is we have this concept that we have an opportunity to observe where we have large crowds of people behaving in a very specific way because of these man-made constructs, right? Like everything is man-made, right? Like Valentine's Day is man-made and New Year's is man. I mean, somebody invented the calendar, right? So New Year's is man-made. New Year's resolutions are man-made. The, you know, the Super Bowl, right? The big, you know, the big time to do something is man-made. Thanksgiving is man-made. Black Friday. I mean, you could argue that Christmas and New Year's also, depending on where you stand religiously. But you know, all these dates and all these seasons and all these priorities that people have around a specific time range, those are all personal choices. I mean, there's people that don't celebrate Super Bowl or whatever, right? Yeah. So these are all choices. So if you know these things are coming, you have plenty of time to prepare for it. Or better, you know, if you don't like being around those crowds, you know, if you could shape your life around doing it differently, then you do it. I'll give you an example. You know, we take our kids to Disney all the time. We never go on a 3-day weekend, Labor Day weekend, Memorial Day weekend. I mean, we're in Florida, so we can drive there. We'll go on a Wednesday. We'll go on a Thursday, on a random day. And not everybody can afford that because most people, you know, are employed. But when I show up to Disney on a Wednesday or a Thursday, and while I'm driving the 4 hours to get me there, I think my decision 10 years ago to open my own business. Because one of the reasons, and I don't know if the vast majority of people watching or listening are employed or they have their own business, that's the reason why we got into our own business in the first place, is for us to choose what our seasonality looks like, right? Don't allow the entire world and the social construct of dates control you. So that's a really important concept. And I think that if you think about it retrospectively and you do work for your own, or you do control your time in one way, shape, or form, what a waste it is for you to control your time, control your schedule, but then adhere to somebody else's schedule like tax season, right? So I wanted to just kind of discuss that because it's a big realization that I personally have when I get to choose to do something during busy times or not during busy times, like I choose to do a podcast in the middle of tax season and just have open discussions that don't necessarily get me new clients and new revenue, because I believe strongly on what this does for me and what this does for the community. So you know, having the capacity to control your schedule should also be having the capacity not to work around somebody else's schedule. And it may take discipline. Again, like you said, it may take discipline of not taking a client, you know, at a specific time, or if they come in afterwards, because we are afraid to lose them. So we may not follow through with that discipline, but that's really the point. Like, a discipline is a set of rules that needs to be followed no matter what. And it's almost like I have a client that doesn't, he's the owner of the company. He doesn't put in the business cards that he's an owner or a manager or a CEO. You know, he put designer or something like that. And I ask him, why don't you put that? He's like, you know what? Because when I go quote my clients a price, or I tell them something about policy, if I'm not the owner, I can just tell them company policy. You know, it's like I'm following somebody else's rules. So it's that concept of, you know, are you abiding by somebody else's rules, or are you making your own rules? And I think that how seasonality affects you personally says a lot about how evolved your practice is. So my practice is not fully evolved as it's going there, because seasonality still affects me, I force myself not to fall into that rut. And I did go to Disney World a couple of weeks ago. That's kind of why I mentioned it. You know, so that's an important piece. So I wanted to just talk about, you know, like, observe the world around seasonality, how people behave around seasonality, and how you choose to work around it or adapt to it or be pretty much controlled by it. So it's one piece that you talked about. I wanted to respond to that. The other thing that you spoke about was specifically when it came to extensions. So a lot of folks don't really understand the concept of extensions, and I don't want to get really nerdy with it, but I'll just explain it real quick. The IRS gives us a deadline to file our returns, which is April 15th for C corps and personal returns, and it's actually March 15th that just passed for LLCs and S corporations. But that April 15th is the last day to pay, and if you pay past that date, you're going to get a late payment penalty. You can still file late under an extension. You can file 6 months later after the deadline. That's the automatic extension that you get if you send the form. It's funny. It's called an automatic extension, but you still have to apply for it. So you apply for an automatic extension. So you apply for the automatic extension and you get 6 months to file, but you don't get an extension to pay. And this is where the high level of priority happens, because a lot of folks just don't have their numbers together. And even if we file an extension, we may not know what the estimated taxes are. And that's really where, that's the entire bottleneck of that seasonality, is not just on the filing date, it's on the payment date. Now, you talked about December 1st, November 1st, and while you were talking about that, it just occurred to me that all the value that we provide as tax accountants happens before January 1st. Yet all the work, all the stress, and all the quote-unquote billable time comes in from January 1st afterwards. Isn't that something? Let me repeat that again. All of the value that tax accountants can bring to the table happens before that December 31st. Why? Because 99% of the things that you like to do strategically for tax planning and as a tax advisor, you can't do after the year's over. So if you're placing too much value, too much stock on the work that you do between January 1st and April 15th, preparing financial statements, preparing tax returns, looking at receipts or whatever, at that point, you're just a historian, right? And you're doing post-mortem tax planning. You can't do much, right? The time passed. But if you're able to somehow convince your client that your value comes, the most amount of value you can give it to them before December 31st, they are the ones that are going to ask, right? You don't have to insert any discipline to them. You just have to communicate to them that that's where the value you can provide. They're the ones that are going to ask for you to, be proactive and work throughout the year instead of waiting for January. I think the key element is figuring out exactly how to communicate that. Like, how do we effectively communicate that our value happens throughout the year, not after December 31st? So that's my response to your comments.
I think you nailed it. It is client selection or customer selection, to use the preferred term. And it involves education. So let's just back up and kind of talk about, okay, and we can use your practice or just theoretical practice. It really doesn't matter. But let's assume, okay, I'm an accountant who has practiced the tax season model for years, and I'm fed up. I'm ready to have regular hours during the first quarter of the year. I'm ready to not have to make choices about, do I take vacation, spring break, or work on my clients' tax returns, et cetera, et cetera. So I've made the decision that is going to change. So where do you start? Well, I think first you've got to think about existing customers. What do you do? Well, you're probably going to need to educate your customers. So how can you do that? Well, number one, you can begin to give them hints that a change is coming. So once you've made this decision, even though you may not, quote, begin to take steps to implement the change, you could begin to lay hints that something's coming. You may have a monthly or quarterly newsletter or even weekly email, some type of regular communication. You could begin to lay the groundwork, say, hey, we're not going to talk about it in specific yet, but I just want to let you know, when we have your annual review coming up in 3 months, one of the things we're going to do is we're going to talk to you about a new business model that we're going to be adopting and how that's going to affect our clients. As we approach that, we encourage you to think about, what do you really want from us as an accountant or a bookkeeper? What would you like to see change? What about our current relationship do you hate? and challenge that and give them, and you could even, you know, if you have stories from customers who are willing to share, you might have a customer who responds to that early and they say, you know what? I just hate that every January we're scrambling. Well, in your newsletter, next one that comes out or your email, you say, hey, here's one example. I don't know if you've noticed this, but this happens a lot. I see it all the time with graphic designers. Customers who want to get a logo or some other type of creative design, they have a hard time coming up with ideas. But once the graphic designer shows them three concepts or three rough drafts, they can quickly go, I don't like that one. I would change this. They can quickly edit and give feedback. And so you can make that tendency of people to prefer to edit rather than create part of your education process. Give them examples of either theoretical things or real stories as part of that. Interviews even. I think your best customers, you ought to be sitting down with them either via Zoom like we're doing or in person saying, hey, we are going to make a change. Here's why we're making a change. And by the way, the why we're making a change, the answer to that is not why it's better for you. It's why it's better for them. You talked about how do you help the customers realize the value? Well, you have a conversation with them about why would it be valuable for us to not have that rush in January? You probably have some ideas, but don't use your ideas, your words. Get it from them. Let them tell you why it's important. And then you can design your service around that. I think this idea of saying, we are not going to be reactionary, we're going to be responsive, we're going to be planning. You're also going to need to assess, are your customers those that want to be that way? In other words, there are some customers who they're just happy to be reactionary. There's no value in planning and being responsive. Guess what? Those are customers that are probably going to need to exit your practice. You need to identify who they are and create a transition strategy. And you might even say, as you begin to educate customers, say, look, here is the model that we're switching to. Here's the reasons we feel like it's valuable for you as a customer. We want to talk about that. And by the way, if you don't feel like this change is going to be positive for you, we have another option that we have already set up for you. You know, and you may not elaborate on any more than that, but ideally you'll have said to somebody else who is happy to, you know, I'm not going to call it tax season anymore, by the way, Hector. I'm officially calling it panic season because that's really what it is. Okay. We're talking about panic season. You find another professional who loves panic season. They may not love it, but they're not willing to implement the discipline to get rid of panic season. And you say, okay, we'll help refer you over that way. I think it boils down to not only the discipline, but the customer selection. And you've got to think about what is your strategy with existing customers. In my opinion, new customers are easy. In fact, if you're going to implement this, you start with new customers. You come up with this idea of, you know, eliminate panic season. I mean, figure out a creative name for it. Ideally, if you have a field that you focus on, maybe you serve funeral directors. Or maybe you specialize in graphic designers, or maybe all your customers are, you know, they are craft breweries or whatever it is, right? You craft it, the name of the offering, the language you use, all of that to that industry, if you can. You may not be able to. Your practice may be more diversified, but ideally that would be the best scenario. Craft it in a way that is going to entice them to want to get there. Responses, thoughts.
You know, that's kind of interesting. First of all, I like just panic season. I love the connotation that it has. I love, I think I'm going to start using it for sure. So I like that. I also like, I like the creativeness behind if you have a niche practice that specializes, you know, you use a term that means, you know, panic or something like that in the industry. That could certainly work just as well, just to make that connection. But I think that giving it a label like that is certainly a great idea. So I would agree that not calling it tax season and calling it something else, so it gets the client out of that shift, because everybody, you know, for them tax season just means, oh, my accountant's busy. I mean, I don't think they think of anything else other than that, but my accountant's busy, right? But that's a big issue, right? Because if your client thinks you're busy, they're not going to give you new projects. And whether the new project is something that you want or don't want, that could be opening the door to something amazing. You know, I've had clients that literally decided to start a new business venture with a partner that I've never met. And this is a true story. This happened to me last year. I have a client that decided a new business venture around April 2nd or something like that with a new partner that I've never met, who was a very wealthy individual. And they started a new business venture, a side venture. And I actually ended up knowing about it later on when I got the K-1, which is the document from that. And I said, wait, you have another business? They're like, oh yeah. Yeah. Back in April last year, we started this business. I'm sorry, I didn't call you because you were busy. And it was a big venture, and it's a profitable venture that they did, and it was a wealthy individual that they partnered up with. And I think that if I would have given the signal that I wasn't busy, he probably would have pushed to his partner, hey, let's work with my accountant instead of your accountant, or whatever the situation was. But it's that notion that because you're busy, you don't have time for your clients. And so that's one thing. The second thing is, if you also create the signal that you're busy, your clients are not going to be too merciful for mistakes that you make. And that's a really important concept, because I got to tell you, I make mistakes. I will admit it here in a public forum. I'm not perfect. I do make mistakes. And the vast majority of the mistakes happen between March 15 and April 15. Why? Because we're compressing, you know, a lot of work in very little time. And the mistakes are not so much of like a practitioner mistake. Like I think I apply the laws well. The mistake is just not asking enough questions and not spending enough time with the client, not digging deep enough. And, you know, we see a couple of big transactions and we ask the questions in such a way that we want a 3-second response, because we know that if they give us the 30-second response, we're going to go down a rabbit hole and we just don't have time to do it. And it's funny. When I'm busy, my conversations with my clients are different, right? I ask questions in a way that I get just the amount of answers that I need to move forward. Whereas when I'm not busy, I'll dig deep. And then we find out that what they needed was something else entirely. So there's huge benefits to what you're saying, to having a smaller practice, clients that are higher quality over quantity. Higher quality, you have more touch points throughout the year. You have more time to discuss your situation. You're understanding and validating their accounting throughout the year, so you can be proactive and giving them advice. And then when it comes to non-panic season between January and April, you can do the return with a couple of clicks. Plus, it's extremely profitable, right? Because you did all the heavy work during the year, during tax season or non-panic season. You prepare the tax return with just a few clicks. And at the same time, you will have all this open capacity to take on the new clients, the ones that may want to pay a premium for doing things late. That's another thing, Kirk. And I know we touch on pricing and we touch on value pricing throughout this podcast, and we haven't dedicated an episode to value pricing and options, and we will, I promise you. We're just trying to get all the advisory stuff out so we can then discuss about the specific of business model and how we make money in this industry. But I think pricing fixes everything. I think if you tell a new customer when they come in on March and they say, I need it done in a month, that if you price it double what you would have priced, you have to show them, say, look, this is the price for next year. If we start doing the books now, and this is the price for next year, and we add up the annualized fees, let's say it's $2,000, and this is the price to do it now, $4,000. If you show them the difference and they go, wait, hold on, how come I'm paying more now? And you're like, well, you're coming in March, you know, but good news, you will pay a lot more now because you want it done now, but good news, next year, we're going to be in a different pricing because we're going to work differently. And I think customers tend to resolve all their discipline problems with price. it's pretty amazing how people almost like shape themselves into their own bucket with price. I mean, just like when I give people options, when I take on a new client for a monthly engagement, the key question I ask is, you know, how quickly do you need a response when you email me or send me? And we'll dedicate an entire episode to response time probably, because response time is a whole nother topic. But people say, hey, you know, how quickly you want a response when you email me, leave me a voicemail, text me a question about tax or accounting. And everybody says immediately or the next day or 24 hours, right? Something that's hard for someone like me that travels and does training and does podcasts and does all sorts of things, right? It has four kids. Most important. So someone like me, it's difficult to promise somebody a 2-day, a 1-day response. Even a 2-day response time is tough for me. So when I give people options, I always give them an option that has the 24-hour response time, and it's like an extra $1,000 a month. And people are like, wait a second, why is it so much? I'm like, it just is. People say, you know what? I can wait 3 days. Yeah. So it's funny. Like what seemed to be the most biggest priority, which is response time. But if you can give them value everywhere else, and you know that 3-day response time it's as good as a 1-day response time, people fix themselves with pricing. So I think almost the whole tax season, panic season element could possibly be fixed strategically just through pricing, right? You give somebody an incredible deal compared to the panic season price. Incredible deal to do it throughout the year. Cut it in pieces, right? You take the entire tax return cost, cut it into 12, give it a 20, 30, 25% discount, whatever. But make people pay throughout the year, which increases your cash flow, by the way. If you're a tax practitioner and you're getting all the tax season money before tax season comes, think about what that does to your cash flow. Incredible. That which also allows you to have, you know, to control more of what staff you can or cannot have or can keep. Because a lot of folks bring in temps during tax season, bring in extra employees during tax season because they have the cash flow coming in, but then they have to get rid of them on April 15th. And if you happen to land an incredible talented person during tax season that you train and you spend all this time training, and now you don't have the cash flow anymore, you're going to have to let them go. So there's tons of business model advantages to charging a tax return throughout the year by breaking them into monthly payments. But make sure the client sees the impact that is more expensive to do everything in one shot versus doing it throughout the year. And they will choose themselves. They will go that route. And even if you're thinking, oh, well, Hector, if I go that route, I'm going to be missing out because a lot of my clients want to pay the top dollar to get everything done last minute. Well, that's a choice that you're making. Like if you want to be on that model, you can be. But forget about taking a vacation between January and April, right? Forget about having family time. Forget about, you know, going out and doing egg hunting on Sunday, which is, you know, coming up with the kids. I know a lot of accounting professionals that don't leave the office even on the weekends because they're so busy. So I think that one, mindset change and business model change for the individual practitioner, for the team, it's crucial. Two, explaining the value to the client up front. And as you said, you nailed it. Why does it benefit them? Why is it advantageous that they have access to us all year long for as much time as they need instead of quick 3 minutes I'm busy during March where you can have an incredible opportunity, fall in your lap and lose it just because you gave the client the impression that you don't have time, or you couldn't just spend an extra 5 minutes asking the right questions to get there. And I think the third element would be price. So it's mindset shift, business model shift, communicating the value to your client to be an anti-tax season practitioner. And of course, I think price could help you shape it. So what do you think about that? I'm just putting a plan, just kind of brainstorming a plan in place.
I completely agree about pricing. In fact, pricing, the decision to change your business model should include, so in my mind, the decision to change your business model is a strategic decision. And part of the tactics you use to implement that strategic decision are pricing techniques. One of the things that occurred to me, you mentioned options. You got two options right out of the box. Do you want to be a panic season client or a non-panic season client? You got two choices right there. All you got to do is come up with a third to offer them three choices. And by the way, panic season client should be the one with the highest value. Why is that highest value? Is because customers, even we as professionals, every single human being does not like change. Find study after study that show we gravitate toward what's comfortable. We will actually stay with what's comfortable, even if it's more painful, because we perceive change being more painful. Putting a high price on what they value the most is one way to influence a decision. By the way, putting a high price on panic season, even if you don't plan to offer it, will help you flush out what customers really value. Ideally, what you want is you want a portfolio. And by the way, I give credit to my VeriSage colleague, Tim Williams, for this idea of thinking about customers as a portfolio. If you're a financial planner, you're not going to put all your money in one area. You're not going to put it all in gold. You're not going to put it all in stocks. You're going to have it spread out across several things so that your risk is allocated across multiple types, so that one thing's down, something else will be up, and that you'll get the return you want over the average, because you're not going to try to predict the weather. Same thing with customers. You need to have some A-class customers, some B-class customers, and some C-class customers. You need to decide what each category of customer looks like for you. And by the way, you probably can pick out what those classes are out of your existing customer base. Your favorite customer to work with, that's your A. Okay, your B, who it may not be as profitable, but they're still, you know, they don't make your life too hard. That's probably your B. And, you know, beyond those two, you can figure out your C. And you might even have a D. D would be the ones you're definitely going to let go. C would be the ones only if they're going to conform to your process and your decisions in your business model, are you going to keep them? And that's really how you've got to approach this. You've got to be, we are going to make this transition. We want to educate, we're going to interview customers to find out what they value, then we're going to communicate this change in their perception of value so that they perceive it as something better. And if their view of value doesn't align with our business model, we're just going to have to let them go. You're just going to have to do that. But yeah, I would say double the panic season price. I mean, make it so astronomical. If you, and here's the thing, if you really don't want to provide it, then you got to be paid so darn well that you're willing to do it anyway. So a double price for panic season price. Shoot, I don't care. Call it panic season. Put some, I mean, we talk about naming options. Put some ugly, nasty name on it. I don't mean cussing, but, you know, something that just your reaction to is like, ugh, you know, the murder option. Right? I mean, you know, you see what I'm saying? Nobody would call it that, but you get my idea, right? The fugly option. I mean, there I am. I said don't cuss, and I almost did. But the idea here is, you know, not only educate them on the value, but use the way you name things. And that's why, you know, we haven't done an episode on productized services. I don't know. I think we've come up with next month's episodes during this one, because we keep saying we need to do an episode on. A productized service, how you name it, the options you give, the prices you set, it will help customers identify what they value by the choices they make. And, you know, this might be debatable, but you know what? If you do it far enough in advance and you have a panic season option, and then after you see, you know, you see the customers who want that, you go, you know what? Those are not the one customers I want. You can say, you know what? We've decided not to offer panic season. So, rather than, you know, do that with you, we've already made arrangements to transition you over to somebody that we recommend who, you know, is more set up to do panic season type of thing. And by the way, I would also characterize this. I think this is one, at least, and this is my mind, you would have to ask your customers, but I think when you start communicating to customers that you're making decisions, you're planning decisions in your own business to improve your quality of life, to minimize the errors that you make. And I thought that was a very courageous observation that you made of yourself, that more errors occurred, you know, during the last month of panic season, right? Because you're just scrambling. And that's, I don't think there's any other word. You're either scrambling or cramming. I think about when I, you know, finals for college, I was a really good test taker. This is, so you admitted something that's not real, you know, elegant about you, right? You make errors. I don't. I'm sorry that happens to you. But the one thing I did do, the one error I've ever made, no, I'm joking. But seriously, I was a good test taker. So in college, I would just cram. I would cram. So you're either cramming or scrambling, one of the two. So lots that I'm throwing out there. But I mean, I'm sitting here in my mind going, I think you and I could create a product on eliminating panic season. That may be something we need to think about. Because, and I'll be honest, I had this happen in my business yesterday. I've got a customer, they're an attorney. They primarily deal in class action lawsuits against employers when employers are not compensating their employees according to laws in certain specific industries. And they had a deadline to meet with the court last night at midnight. He emailed me at like 4:15 and said, hey, we need to make one more change to, you know, I wrote a software system to help them figure out an equitable settlement because they had thousands of you know, plaintiffs as part of the settlement. And I was like, and I assumed the deadline was 5. And so literally I could go to the emails yesterday. My first email to him was, I cannot get it back to you, you know, in time. And then he responded back. I can't remember what he said, but I said, look, I'm not even going to be back to my office till 5 o'clock. I was actually out running errands. He goes, oh, we have till midnight. I'm like, okay, well, fine. Then I can help you. So I made an assumption his deadline was 5. He knew it was midnight. Midnight, we never communicated that. So that's part of that response time thing. I don't know. I'm going to have to let you wrap this up because I'm getting full of energy here. We're going to do part two. No, I'm joking, but I could do another hour on it.
Sure. I want to wrap things up. I want to say that other industries do this, right? There's a market for procrastinators, right? For example, if you got to get to Atlanta, you know, within the next 4 hours and you show up to the airport because someone died or whatever, and or you have a business meeting, a deal you're going to close, whatever, let's just do the positive side. You're going to pay $2,000 to get on a plane, right? Even if there's capacity, even if you're like, you think, oh, well, you know, I'll just be on a waiting list and I'll get on the next airplane that has an open spot and they will take me because they rather fill the hole. That's actually not true. They know that there's a market for procrastinators, for last minute people. And they would charge you an arm and a leg because they almost create capacity for that. Hotels do that, right? Hotels always save 2-3 rooms. They say they're sold out for the ones that will pay double, triple, quadruple because they have to stay that night, right? I mean, that's just travel and hospitality. I mean, if you go to rent a car and they don't have any of the economies left, and this happens all the time. Sometimes I think that they say they don't have economies left, but they only have, you know, the Mustang and you have to pay $50 more for it, right? I mean, this is how the world functions. If you procrastinate, if you wait for last minute, if you have less choices, you're going to pay more. And you know, think about the emergency room, right? Sometimes you go in the emergency room, they touch you, they give you Percocet, you go home, whatever, it was a false alarm. It's an $800 bill. You're like, shoot, I could have called my doctor, I could have, you know. But why did that happen? It's because, you know, this place has built capacity to intake that emergency work and can charge a premium for it. So if as accountants, we are acting like an emergency room and not charging like an emergency room, we're leaving money on the table. We're adding undue stress to our practice. We're missing the opportunity to educate our customers. Yes, we want to take the customers. We want to grow our practice. But if you take them in during panic season and you act like panic season is nothing, I think next year they're going to treat you like panic season and it will happen over and over and over. And I'm a culprit of that and I'm living that. And re-educating someone 2, 3, 4 years after that, hey, I don't do panic season, they're like, well, you did it fine the rest of the time. Because most of them don't, you know, they're not the ones sharing the stress with you. your customers are not living with you. They're not working with you until 12 o'clock at night. I mean, some may get my emails at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, wow, you're working a lot. But beyond that response, you know, they're being empathetic, but they really don't care. You know, it's, you know, you're charging what you're charging and you're, they say you're a professional, you're charging your fees, I'm paying my fee, I'm done with you. I don't need to, like, you know, be worried about your worries around panic season. So if we are going to intake all that pain and not charge a premium for it. And by the way, I'm not saying we should charge a premium to penalize our clients. We charge the premium to reshape their thinking of our clients so they auto-fix themselves. Because I think pricing fixes everything. If you are great at giving value on whatever you do, software consulting, database programming, accounting, tax, if you're great at what you do and you build rapport with your client, you have connection and you have trust, but you set a boundary around timing and that requires the client to change themselves in order to accommodate to the boundaries you're giving. And by the way, you're not a czar. Like you should, you know, you're not a Nazi. Like you will be flexible in one way, shape, or form. But you can't allow 100 clients to all come in the last month and you take them willy-nilly, same price as everyone else, causing all this undue stress. So I could also go a whole hour because you know, this has made me think. I'm talking about the things that I'm doing wrong and I'm also talking about how to fix them, but I got to fix them myself. So that's it, Kirk. I think this was a fascinating hour. It flew by and we probably should talk about, I think response time may be something that we should discuss very briefly because this whole concept of timing, I think it plays a big role in advisory and it plays a big role in pricing. And it actually, I think timing sort of ties, you know, the pricing, profitability, and an advisory element together somehow. Because, you know, as an advisor, you probably have the answers the client wants. You probably have the insight the client wants. And you would have it at any point in time, any time of the day, during tax season, during summer, 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock in the morning. Our profitability comes in on the timing. You know, when does the client want it? Can we give the client the time when they want it? And can we take multiple projects at the same time around timing? So I think, you know, timing, project management, response time, all that stuff has to undergo a major shift, mindset shift, business model shift in order for you to achieve, you know, getting rid of tax season altogether.
So Hector, I'm going to wrap it up by saying this. If you have thoughts about getting rid of panic season, please leave a comment below this video on Facebook. We'd love to get not only your thoughts, but if you have questions, if something we said has sparked an idea or you'd like to go deeper, let us know what you think. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.
Yes. See you next week, Kirk.